From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The online retail giant and now film and TV production company Amazon has teamed up with Berkshire Hathaway and JP Morgan Chase to come up with a plan to offer healthcare for their hundreds of thousands of workers. The plan was announced as one that would be, quote, free from profit-making incentives and constraints. Amazon has grown so spectacularly that the company's search for a location for its second headquarters has triggered a massive bidding war among dozens of U.S. cities, many of which are offering overly generous subsidies to the corporation. But the quality of jobs that this second headquarters would bring is likely not very good. Amazon founder and CEO Jeff Bezos has boasted about disrupting the economy with his innovative thinking. But the corporation's treatments of workers suggests he is also interested in disrupting traditional notions of workers' rights and dignity. My guest is Jessica Bruder. She's an award-winning journalist whose work focuses on subcultures and the dark corners of the economy. She teaches at the Columbia School of Journalism, and her books include Burning Book, A Visual History of Burning Man, and Nomad Land, Surviving America in the 21st Century. A short film based on Nomad Land was recently released called Camper Force. Welcome to the program, Jessica.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
So people who want to actually watch the interview we did with you some months ago about Nomadland can find that on our website. And that book is based largely on the workforce that Amazon has recruited that are primarily senior citizens who are sort of nomadic workers who are able to go from place to place. So you are quite familiar with the way in which Amazon has attempted to kind of subvert traditional means of recruiting workers and training them. Let's talk about these new aspects that have come up about Amazon and how it's how cities around the country are so excited about having a second headquarters. There is one headquarters already. What would the second headquarters entail? What would a city that hosts the second headquarters get from Amazon, as far as you can tell?
Well, they'd get jobs, but the question is, are these the jobs we really want? There's been some backlash in Seattle about the culture there.
And that's that's the main headquarters, yeah.
That's where the main headquarters is. And there was an amazing story, as we know, that came out in 2015 from the New York Times, just looking at Amazon's corporate culture and the fact that they kind of look at people the way resources are looked at in extraction. I mean, it almost makes me think of human fracking, where it's basically, they're the experts at extracting productivity from either the human meat or the human mind, and often not entirely mindful of the cost. I mean, we see news stories coming out with now Whole Foods employees are weeping because of the scorecards. We see in the New York Times a couple of years ago that, you know, you haven't worked in the Amazon headquarters in Seattle particularly long if you haven't seen everybody around you weep. So I think the question is, we get these jobs, but at what cost? And Amazon coming to communities and shaking them down for tax breaks and all sorts of subsidies isn't new. It's something that's been going on with much less fanfare for a very long time in terms of where and how they locate their warehouses.
So there is a petition going around where some are asking cities to sign on to a letter to sort of have a pact between them to not give everything away. If they sort of collectively come together and say, we're not going to give you these overly generous subsidies, then, you know, Amazon is the one that's forced to sort of decide what it can, where it can put its headquarters without having these kind of battles breaking out that end up lowering the bar over and over again. So as far as you can tell, what are some of the things that Amazon is asking from its future location for its second headquarters? There was one article that said the state of Illinois was considering giving some sort of subsidy that would have been based on its workers' salaries.
Oh, the whole thing is crazy. I mean, I've been comparing this to the Hunger Games for late-stage capitalism. It's getting really ugly. I hadn't heard about the petition you just mentioned, and I kind of love that. It almost mirrors what has to happen on the worker level. It's just like, we need unions of workers to have bargaining power. Maybe in this era, we need unions of cities to actually push back at this monolithic corporate force. What's happening is really, really freaky. I mean, basically, we've got the city of Newark, and I'm a native New Jersey, and I live in New York now. But, you know, they're offering $7 billion in tax breaks. People
wow.
are offering subsidies, all sorts of resources. There was a report out of the city of Chula Vista in California recently, an investigative report, talking about how much they were willing to give away. And they hadn't even done a long-term study to look at what Amazon would bring them. It's just, there's this ridiculous fervor that does make me think of the Hunger Games. And it's funny, I'm wary of saying, oh, the mainstream media does this, the mainstream media does that, because I often find that those critiques are overbearing, and I am part of the media. But I do have to say, in this particular case, I do believe the mainstream media is complicit in treating this like a sporting event.
It is. It's also reminiscent of cities that vie to host the Olympics, right, on a global scale.
Yeah, when everybody has their Olympic bids and everybody's kind of promoting themselves, and the showmanship is really disgusting. And I say that because Amazon has set it up like it's a competition, like these cities need to tell Amazon about who they are. Amazon knows who they are. I mean, the level of showmanship, the pageantry of it, it really does turn my stomach, because it's really all about turning these cities upside down, shaking them by the ankles, and seeing what tax incentives fall out of their pockets.
Right. I mean, basically, Amazon seems to have turned the tables on the dynamic between location and corporation. 238 cities made bids to host it, and then Amazon disclosed its short list of 20 regions. So this major contest. And of course, the cities at the top are the ones that offer the greatest financial incentives. But what is the quality of jobs that it would bring? I mean, there are, of course, the perhaps the most high profile job that we think of when we think of Amazon are the warehouse workers that actually put the products in that people order into boxes that come to us. But a headquarters would be basically where people, workers, would be part of the nuts and bolts of how the corporation is run, right? So what are the sort of jobs that it would be bringing?
Yeah, so those are more white-collar jobs. It's most of my work has looked at the more blue-collar jobs. But one of the most revelatory pieces of journalism looking inside the white-collar culture of Amazon really was that 2015 New York Times piece, which it was a Jody Cantor story. I can't recommend it highly enough to your audience, where, again, it's an analog to what happens on the warehouse floor in terms of extracting productivity. But instead of extracting it from bodies, it's extracting it from brains. And it's a work till you break sort of thing. And when you consider that wherever this headquarters ends up, Amazon is going to be getting these really plush tax breaks, and you think about all the local small businesses that don't receive the same benefits that Amazon is systemically working to undermine and will be taking advantage of the same resources these tax breaks are funding. And the fact that, again, tax dollars are public money. These could go into education. They could go into our infrastructure, which is really falling apart in a lot of the country. I mean, it's just a really, really ugly scenario.
Right. I mean, that's a really critical aspect of the story that needs to be brought up, which is that every dollar that a city gives to Amazon is $1 out of its treasury, out of the budgets that serve, you know, ordinary people. The whole Amazon purchase of Whole Foods has been a really interesting example or experiment, if you will, to see what Amazon does to a workforce. Because in this particular case, when Amazon bought up Whole Foods, it came into a company that already had a culture where workers, you know, and Whole Foods has plenty of critique. There's plenty of things to criticize about Whole Foods before Amazon bought it. But in general, the sense was that the workers in the stores were relatively happy, liked working there. I remember going to a Whole Foods store right after the purchase and asking one of the cashiers if they were excited or if there was a change. And they said, no, they were really optimistic about Amazon being their new boss. Now we just heard a new story, Alternet published a story that said Whole Foods workers revolt after Amazon imposes dystopian grading system. And the subtitle was Crying at Work is Becoming Normal. What has Amazon done to Whole Foods?
Oh, and it's wild too, because the Alternet story, I just want to point this out, because we know Alternet as a really strong side on the progressive area of the spectrum. But the interesting thing is that Alternet story came out of a Business Insider story. And Business Insider is not known as, you know, oh, the progressive media, right? So what Business Insider revealed was that Amazon has basically, Whole Foods is using a whole different checklist system now. They're bringing in scorecards, tests called WAPs, that basically get people to comply with this new inventory management system. That system alone was making headlines a couple of weeks ago when apparently entire shelves and aisles at Whole Foods were empty. I don't know if you heard about that, but that sounded pretty wild. It was freaking people out in a dystopian kind of, oh my gosh, is this what happens before the bread lines way? But again, I feel like what a company like Amazon always argues is, if we can measure it, again, this goes back to Taylorism, this goes back to automation and the Ford assembly plants, right? If we can measure it, we can improve upon it. But the modern day corollary of that is we end up with something that folks call management by stress, where data is a proxy for control. And if you can measure it, you can ratchet it up and you can basically extract more productivity. But often, again, the collateral damage is on the worker, right? Where it's kind of this almost, if you think of I Love Lucy in the bonbon factory, if you think of Charlie Chaplin in modern times getting stuck in the gears, there's only so fast things can go. And there are only so fast things can go before you reach an emotional breaking point for human beings who are finite creatures and don't do everything in ones and zeros.
Right. I mean, you know, certainly one can force a human being to be more and more productive and have greater precision in the long term. However, that literally undermines that human being's ability to be human, right? I mean, we are not machines and we shouldn't try to be machines.
I mean, it has a toll on the body, too. When I talked to a lot of workers, so many people were experiencing a lot of repetitive stress injuries and really bad ones from using these Amazon barcode scanners. And just the other day, we don't know where this is going to lead. It came out that Amazon had filed patents for a new kind of haptic bracelet that would basically provide haptic feedback. So again, maybe it's a vibration or a pulse, but just something on your wrist that helps direct you to the right box in like a warehouse, which is interesting because one of the most challenging jobs in an Amazon warehouse is the work of the picker, the person who's taking the objects off the shelf. And Amazon has been trying to eliminate that role for years. They've been trying, they've held competitions where people bring in robots that could do the picker job, but there's just something in terms of grasping and in terms of recognizing objects, and the robots haven't gotten anywhere near the human skills yet. So what it sounds like, and again, this is all speculative because it's a patent application, right? And that's all we know, is that if they can't bring the robots in, they're going to just keep bringing people closer to the robots.
Wow. So a wristband that essentially guides humans to the right place, I'm assuming it might also be one that would help keep track of where that human being is, where a central command would be able to track its workers, so that they might be able to shave, what, an extra minute off of each action and then thereby extract more profit. Incredible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's a lot of the work the handheld scanner does now. So I'm guessing this is kind of an upgrade on that.
And just going briefly back to the Whole Foods story, Whole Foods workers are now Amazon workers. The Business Insider article interviewed a worker at Colorado Whole Foods, at a Whole Foods in Colorado. And this person explained this sort of scoring system. Every item in our department has a designated spot that is labeled or marked. If that item is even an inch out of its designated spot, we receive negative marks. And so these workers that had enjoyed a somewhat dignified workplace under Amazon are now being tracked. That does not have a very positive impact in the long term on workers, because that tells you your employer is like a big brother that's going to scare you into submission and being a productive worker. So my question to you is this, Jessica, because certainly Whole Foods, you know, it's a sort of a luxury health food store. It's high priced. And Amazon may change that because it has changed the retail industry. So the question becomes, does Amazon's profitability, the fact that it provides customers unarguably a very convenient experience, it's so convenient to be able to order things off of Amazon, have it arrive on your doorstep a day or two later, does that profitability depend on treating its workers in this way? Or can they actually have dignified worker rights, you know, dignity for its workers, and that level of consumer experience and a profitable company?
I think they could be profitable without it. I mean, I really, really do. For so long, Amazon was about domination. I mean, it's only in recent years, and a lot of people forget about this. They were all about dominating the marketplace. It was amazing the shareholders held on. They really believed in it, because only recently, now that they own everything, are they becoming profitable. And
that's right. That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
And it's freaky, because there's so much. When we talk about what Amazon's become and we think about monopolies, the scary thing is, giant monopolies, it's not that they're inherently evil, it's just that they're not really compatible with democracy. And that's one of the big things I'm worried about right now. So could Amazon profit as much if they treated their workers better? I mean, maybe not. Maybe there is a trade-off, but that's an important conversation we need to have, because again, we're people. I don't believe the soul of the human and the reason we're here is to be efficient. I mean, how depressing would that be? You know, the meaning of life, efficiency, right? But in the kind of race to the bottom, Amazon is the master of efficiency. Look at Amazon Go. Look at all these ideas of, you know, we can have a bookstore without people in it. I mean, what do we really need people for anyway, right? This gets existential pretty quickly.
Let's talk about the plan to come up with healthcare. This is an interesting story. So Jeff Bezos, the Amazon CEO and founder, teamed up with Warren Buffett, who is essentially one of the most progressive billionaires out there, and Jamie Dimon certainly is a person who doesn't necessarily have that label, maybe liberal. But these three men, these three massively wealthy CEOs who have a combined workforce with their three corporations that runs into the hundreds of thousands, have realized that they can cut costs of healthcare for their workers if they were to do it themselves. Now they look at it, or they've presented it with the spin of they're going to disrupt the healthcare industry. And in fact, some insurance companies' stock fell when that plan was announced. But it sounds really nice when the announcement said that they were looking for healthcare that would be free from profit-making incentives and constraints. What do you make of this?
I'm a little skeptical about that. Now, keep in mind, apart from just making an announcement, they really haven't told us very much at all about what they're doing. I mean, I think you pretty much just summed it up right now quite beautifully, but we know very, very little. I think at the end of the day, well, the funny thing is, so many of the workers I've interviewed at Amazon are temps. They're the most precarious workers. But one of the funny things is, while a lot of them are not eligible for things like health insurance through Amazon, for those who are, I've heard that people are actually pretty happy with their insurance right now.
Huh.
So I don't, just in terms of people who are permanent Amazon workers. So in the warehouse, they'd be called a blue badge. That means they're full-time rather than, you know, trying to climb up that ladder to get a full-time job. So the funny thing is, I haven't heard of people who actually get insurance being unhappy with the quality of that insurance, which again, makes me think towards.
And does Amazon offer its full-time workers a health insurance plan through the traditional health insurance market right now?
They do. They do.
And to so the they probably
aren't unhappy. That's one thing I know that I haven't heard people being unhappy about. So I'm a little skeptical here. They have mentioned cost cutting. Just knowing what I know about Amazon, I really think cost cutting is probably the issue rather than
exactly
bringing an Amazon smile on workers' faces.
Exactly. That's what I was just about to say, is that it's the fact that the workers are relatively happy with their health insurance doesn't mean much if Amazon realizes it's just costing them too much to deliver that good health care. If they can cut costs, since they have so many workers, if they can cut costs by doing that themselves, that would be better. Now, of course, if we in the United and one of the things that Amazon points out, and that this joint letter from these three corporations points out, is that it's the cost of healthcare for their U.S. workers. That implies that cost of healthcare in the U.S. Is much higher than elsewhere. If this country had universal single-payer healthcare, this wouldn't be an issue. And wouldn't these three CEOs be better off pouring money into lobbying the government and supporting single-payer healthcare for all Americans?
I like the way you're thinking, Sonali. I wish they would listen to you. I think they might not. However, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do think in the richest country in the world, healthcare, we're at the point where healthcare should be a human right. I mean, it's something we could do. It's something that I think in the long term would save us money, because right now our healthcare model is so much about putting out fires, people going to the emergency room at the last minute rather than getting preventative care, which is not only better for you as a human, but costs less. So much of being out on the road and traveling with a lot of people who are getting the short end of the stick for my last book, I was really shocked by how much of our healthcare system is getting outsourced to GoFundMe. GoFundMe is the new model of healthcare, where you've got people who essentially have to do the social media parade. Again, everything is pageantry now, whether it's Amazon's headquarters competition or people saying, look, you should really help me and I've got to trot out my private misery to actually get the funding I need to, you know, keep my body together. It's just a really, really ugly time for that. So yeah, I'm in favor of single payer too.
Healthcare, funerals, you name it, GoFundMe is unfortunately the way that people are now crowdsourcing very basic needs in life. And finally, I'm wondering, Jessica, if there is something that Amazon workers can learn from their European counterparts. Last fall, Amazon workers in Germany and Italy had massive strikes. They were upset about the Black Friday rush. Apparently, there's Black Friday in Europe as well, which I didn't realize. But there is a stronger culture of workers' rights, workers' dignity, labor power in Europe, and I think we've seen revolts of that nature from Amazon workers in the US, and maybe that's what we need to put Jeff Bezos on notice.
We need a union. And I think union culture,
Are Amazon, as far as you know, are European Amazon workers unionized?
I don't know. I don't know. That's the honest answer there. Yeah. But also in Europe, the social safety net is much more robust.
Right.
So people can take risks like that. They can stand up to their employers because, they're not going to be out on the street doing GoFundMe.
Right.
And in this case, it's funny, when I was reporting out of an Amazon warehouse in Hazlitt, Texas, I spoke with workers there. And a couple weeks before I arrived, there were union organizers in the parking lot. And from what I was told directly from several of the workers was that during the morning meetings, which are called stand-up, Amazon representatives would basically try to scare the workers out of talking to the union organizers, saying things like, oh, once they get your information, they can track you. You're in the system with them for the rest of your life, and things are really good here, and you don't want to disrupt it. And people are scared. And from what I heard, it sounded like the managers were really capitalizing on that to discourage unionization at all costs. I think Amazon is terrified of unionization, although maybe they don't have to be, because we just don't have a very strong union culture right now. So I think while it would be great for workers and something that could actually restore a bit of the balance of power, they're probably not that worried about it because there's just not that much of an impetus for it right now.
Well, that could change in the coming years. Finally, I also want to ask you to tell us a little bit about the short documentary that was produced based on your book. The last time we spoke was about your book, Nomadland, and it was this incredible look at how Amazon has tapped into this mobile workforce of seniors to help with its seasonal, extra work that is required. And you, I understand, was able to sort of go undercover to get some really good footage for this documentary. We'll play a clip from that in just a moment. Tell us about the film and how you got access to some of the footage.
Yeah, so the film happened incidentally. I was working directly with Camperforce. I applied for a job and was hired.
And Camperforce is that program, the Amazon program, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, Amazon Camperforce is a program that started literally months after the housing collapse in 2008. And it's something that every year since Amazon has used to bring a mobile workforce, a temporary workforce, in for the months leading up to Christmas. And a lot of these people are at or nearing traditional retirement age. They're in RVs, they're in late model vans, they're in travel trailers. Many of them got whacked by the recession, and others are just struggling in a low wage economy where housing prices keep going up. So it's kind of a captive audience, a captive workforce for Amazon, and they show up, they do the work, they require very little in terms of benefits or anything else, and then at the end of the season, they're gone. So I spent some time working myself with Camperforce. I just straight up applied for a job, went in, And one of my note-taking strategies, I often take a lot of photographs when I'm just out doing regular reporting. I like having a visual reference for what I'm doing. So in this case, I brought in a small camera. It was a small HD video camera. The light was so bad I couldn't take stills. It's very sallow yellow light in there. So I did end up doing a bunch of short videos that I just intended to write off of. I was speaking with Laura Poitras, who your audience might know from Citizen Four.
Right.
That film about Snowden was her baby. She was the one who went to Hong Kong. He initially reached out to her. So I was chatting with her about the project, and she said, "Oh, did you get any footage?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I kind of have. I call it my not so steady cam footage from being in the warehouse." And she ended up looking at it, and through her, the documentary unit she co-founded called First Look Media. Well, Field of Vision is part of First Look Media, sorry. So through Field of Vision, she connected me with director Brett Story. She's amazing. She did a film called The Prison in 12 Landscapes, which is this incredible meditation on mass incarceration in America. So she connected us up and we hit the road together. And it was incredible. We went back and interviewed some of the people who were in Nomad Land, a couple that was on the road and doing camper for us after they'd lost everything in the recession. We went out to some of the places where Amazon's camper force recruiters look for warm bodies to bring to the warehouses and watched that. And altogether, it became this short 16-minute documentary that came out in December through Field of Vision.
And we will play for our audience a clip from that documentary after we say goodbye to you, Jessica. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Jessica Bruder is an award-winning journalist. Her work focuses on subcultures and the dark corners of the economy. She teaches at Columbia School of Journalism. Her books include Burning Book: A Visual History of Burning Man and Nomadland: Surviving America in the 21st Century. And here is an excerpt from her short film, Camper Force, based on Nomadland.
Welcome, everyone. Good afternoon. My name is Kelly, and I'm a Camper Force administrator at our Campbellsville, Kentucky location. So just want to say thanks so much for taking the time to join us today as we discuss the opportunities available at Amazon. We'll talk about the different positions available, and we'll go into some of the benefits of joining the Amazon Camper Force program this season.
So what are you paying on the average?
So on average, about $12. But you are eligible for overtime. It's our warehouse work, so anywhere from picking customer orders to packing customer orders. We have a process called stow, where you're taking product and putting it on a shelf.
My first question is, does everyone know what a work camper is, or is anyone work camping right now? The people who hire work campers are all different types of employers. So we have everyone from like small mom and pop type of situations. And then we have other employers like Amazon where they hire hundreds. So at one location, they might be looking for 400 work campers to come in, help them with their peak season, and then leave at a desired date. They want to kind of bring in a work camper, lower their expenses, and allow you to see the area while just kind of getting the best of both worlds.
We looked for jobs, and being naive the first year, didn't know that there were actually campgrounds that paid you and gave you free hookup and so forth. It took meeting other campers to find out, hey, don't work for somebody that doesn't pay you.
Right.
So. And then they told us about Amazon, and that we were excited about that because of the $11 an hour. So we applied for Amazon, and they said, "Come on down." In a normal shift, if you're a picker, which is a job I did, which meant I had a scanner in my hand, and the scanner would tell me to go pick up a box of Oreo cookies in the purple section, third floor. I would go there, and then I'd get another scan, go pick up some STP oil in the green section, which is the opposite side of the warehouse, which the warehouse is two football fields or three football fields. So I would end up on a 10-hour shift walking 15 to 17 miles a day.
You're going to be doing really physical work here. Body mechanics are very important, but think about it while you're doing things. Bending, stretching, don't push yourself to the point where you are in pain.
Product came in on a belt, take it out of the boxes, and the workers would put the boxers on a conveyor belt above their head.
We must be able to work at a relatively quick pace. We must be able to bend and twist and push and pull. You also may climb some stairs during your shift as well. Finally, we'll ask if you have the ability to lift up to 25 pounds alone and up to 49 pounds with assistance.
I happened to be walking under the belt one time. The box came down, hit me in the head. I fell down, hit my head on the cement floor. The gentleman that was taking care of me stood me up and he said, follow my fingers, followed my finger, and you're doing fine, so you can go back to work.
When you leave the facility every day, there's a smile on your face and we wonder what in the heck is wrong with those people, they're so happy. But that's just who you are, so we do appreciate so much your mature approach that helps us meet and exceed our customer expectations year after year after year.
It was harder than I thought it was going to be. I mean, I didn't think I would be in pain. I knew it was going to be a physical job, but I didn't know I'd be in pain after I was done with the job. At night, because of using those scanners, although the third year, I think they made them a little less, they cut down on the weight of them.
Yeah.
But at night, you'd wake up and you'd have no feeling in your hand whatsoever.
Our third year, I met a lot more people that was a young age, in their 30s and 40s. First year in Fernley, I didn't see any young people.
And then, except for Jen and Ashley.
That was the second year.
Oh, was that the second year?
Yeah, that was the second year.
Okay.
And then after that, we're seeing more single women, single guys mm-hmm. in their RVs and doing the lifestyle.
Well, you talk to them and they say, well, we don't want to happen to us what happened to you guys. The American dream is changing.
Why do you think Amazon targets retirement age workers for Camper Force?
Because we are good. Because we've already been there and we're there to make the money. That's what we're there for. We're not learning anything. We're not starting a new career. We just need the money. So we're going, and they can count on us because they know we need the money.
And you've been watching a short clip from the documentary Camper Force. We will link to the entire film from our website, risingupwithsonali.com, later today. The film came after the book Nomadland that my guest Jessica Bruder had written. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.